Every day when you log into ChumbaCasino.com, the ultimate online social casino, you get a free daily bonus. Imagine if you got daily bonuses in other parts of your life.
I chose French fries over loaded French fries.
I asked Stuart from accounting about his weekend, even though I don't care.
I updated my operating system without having to call tech support.
Collect your free daily bonus at ChumbaCasino.com now. And live the Chumba life. VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have another fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favor to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys, you're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
Right, guys, welcome back to The Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today. My guest today is Adam Kelly. Good afternoon, Adam. How are you, man?
Good afternoon, Yas. Thanks very much for the invitation to join you today.
I'm really excited to have you here. Maybe just before we get started and really into the thick of the conversation, just a brief insight and a background around who you are, what you do, and we can kind of go from there.
Yeah. So I'm an associate prof in sport and exercise at Birmingham City University in the United Kingdom. I'm also the director of the Research for Athlete and Youth Sport Development Lab that we've got there. We've got various projects ongoing at the minute, specifically around talent identification, development, and youth sport. Most specifically, I think, working with the FIFA Talent Development Scheme and looking at how we can measure the impact of their global project, as well as capturing some of the good practice that they're doing. We also have a project called the BESTA Project, which is focused on cricket, working with BCU, the ECB, SACA, the South Asian Cricket Academy, Take Her Lead, as well as ACE, the Afro-Caribbean Exchange. And we're specifically looking to try and think about how we can identify and develop cricketers from more diverse backgrounds and create a more inclusive talent ID and development system in England. So, yeah, a couple really strong projects there that really looking forward to getting involved in, because we're very much at the infancy of those.
Awesome. And just already you've got my mind bubbling in terms of, right, where do we start? I guess, the first question that kind of really jumps out at me is probably a highly debated one, but one that probably you're well versed in, is what is talent?
Wow, you've thrown a bombshell out there straight away. I guess, I don't know what talent is as well as you do, but we know that it is impacted by various different biases, and that can be based on various different things, such as like the social cultural context, people's perceptions and confirmation bias, as well as how the organizational structures are created, which impacts things on relative age, biological age, training age, and then even things like relative access to wealth, social cultural background. There's lots of different things that can impact upon what talent actually is, which I think we know more about rather than what talent is. So a lot of the work that we're doing is focused more specifically on how can we create better organizational structures and more appropriate settings to then try and create an environment where every young athlete can potentially achieve their potential.
I think it's quite interesting because obviously, what I'm hearing you say that essentially is there isn't a definition for it because it's subjective, effectively. But we're aware of all the factors that might have an influence and an impact on it. So I guess, straight from that, it kind of just reminds me of some of the experiences I've had as a coach myself, and even in potentially recruiting of players at times. And you are often challenged with these biases and often having these conversations where
you know, two coaches could look at the same person, or even two scouts or two talent identifiers, if you like, look at the same individual and have a completely different perspective or an opinion on where that person can maybe develop, or at what, whether they've reached their ceiling or not, if you like. But a question I often come back and ask, and it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on this, is, are we sometimes judging the talent and the potential of that individual based on what we're actually seeing, or subconsciously our ability to enhance and develop it further, if that makes sense?
Yeah. There's a bit of a topical debate at the minute around performance versus potential. And the word versus is almost like they're two different constructs, but I guess like they're intertwined. So probably better to describe it as performance and potential. So if you look at age group athletes, you'll have athletes who are competing better, they're better performers. So they might be scoring more goals, or like running faster, or whatever it is that they're doing better than the other athletes. But we're not necessarily taking into consideration some of the things as to why they are performing better. So some of the obvious stuff that's often talked about within the research, and more so practice more recently, is like relative age. So if someone's born earlier in the year, they're going to have an older training age, which can have a knock-on effect of things like their physiological skills, their technical tactical skills, their psychosocial characteristics, which makes them better performers within that age group. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be the best performers at adulthood. And I guess the whole purpose of talent pathways is to create athletes or players who are going to be successful at adulthood. So it's really important we understand like what performance is, but also what potential looks like. Now, where the tricky thing comes in is, you can judge performance is quite easy. I don't think you need to be a talent ID specialist to watch a match or a game or an event and see who the best player or athlete is. So if it's athletics, for example, someone runs further or runs faster or jumps further, they're often identified as the best, but they're probably doing that because they might have advanced maturity status. So it doesn't mean they're necessarily going to be the best runner or jumper when they're adults. And it's the same is true in the majority of sports. However, when we look at potential compared to performance, it's almost like looking into a crystal ball. You're trying to predict the future. So we want to know if someone has the potential to be a top performer when they're older. So it's a lot easier for people to watch a game and judge athletes on performance rather than potential. So what are indicators of potential? And I guess that's where coaches and practitioners come in with their skill set to use or create some of those indicators of potential.
So, you know, just on that then, you know, obviously from the research that you've done, obviously it sounds like there's probably many different ways and people can approach this, because obviously it's going to be subjective to what the environment, the context they're working in. They're going to be looking at specific factors and indicators based on that, that will align itself potentially to that organization or the preferences of the coach or the practitioner in this case. What are some consistent things that people dive into straight away? Because essentially, you know, like you said, performance is something that's probably more objective to identify, right? Whereas the potential aspect is, you know, is probably very influenced by the organization, the outcomes they're looking for, maybe the values and beliefs of that organization and the philosophies approached within those organizations or the individual themselves as well.
Yeah. And again, it's a really tricky concept or conversation, because performance is an important factor as part of potential. So for example, if you're slow, you're not going to be a 100-meter sprinter when you're older. Or if you're not a great football player, doesn't mean that you're going to be a like professional when you're older. So it's, yeah, there has to be some elements of performance when you're judging potential. But I think we need to judge the potential of athletes based upon their individual circumstances at their moment. So it's really important that we don't judge based on how they fit within that group at that moment. So I've used relative age as an example already, but it's something that I've researched quite extensively. If you're born in England on the 1st of September or the 31st of August, you're going to compete in the same age group, but there's going to be up to 12 months difference. So they are going to perform better at that moment. So we need to make sure coaches and selectors understand that the person born in September is going to be better at that moment than the person born in August. However, it doesn't mean that the person born in August in 12 months' time is going to be, you know, better or at an advanced rate as compared to the other athlete. So we really need to judge them based upon individual circumstances rather than as a collective. And there's so much research out there to show within talent pathways, those who were born in the first 3 months are hugely overrepresented compared to those born in the last 3 months. Mm. It's the same as when it comes to biological age. You know, there's not many later maturing athletes within high performance talent pathways. And then we look at other characteristics such as relative access to wealth and ethnicity when it comes to sports like cricket, even things like athletics or snow sports, because you need finances in order to be able to get into those sports in the first place. So you know, there's probably lots of potential skiers or expert horse jumpers out there who don't even know it because they don't have the possibilities to get involved in those sports. But yeah, it's I guess some of those indicators, it's more about understanding what is going to impact upon your decision making rather than what is the actual indicators of potential.
Yeah, no, so essentially we're saying it's a raising of the considerations that could have an influence on it.
Yeah. So making sure coaches are aware of the individual's relative age, their biological age, their training age, their background in terms of relative access to wealth, previous engagements in other sports, lots of different things that could influence their potential in the longer term, rather than just getting players or athletes in for trials and judging them based on how good they are at that moment.
Just on that then, you know, you talked about, you know, effectively a recruitment process in the form of a trial, maybe, you know, is there any kind of best practice that you've kind of observed through that process that allows them ample time, sufficient time in a timely manner as well to actually identify these things?
I guess that leads us onto another point I was keen to make. And talent identification is a really topical thing within the whole realm of youth sport at the moment. And I've been part of a network who've recently formed the Talent Identification and Developmental Environments for Sport Network. And we've got 40 to 50 researchers, as well as some high profile practitioners from all over the world who regularly come together and talk about these topics. And one of the things we're really keen on is talent identification and thinking about what are the actual key principles of talent identification when it comes to recruiting athletes for the talent pathways and identifying those who do have the potential. And the discussion after we were talking about all the different things we need to think about is the first one is we need to put the person before the athlete and remember that this whole process is largely built around children. Therefore, we need to meet the needs of children and young people. So before we go out and do all these things around recruitment, trials, etc., we need to make sure we have child protection policies in place. We need to make sure that we have staff who are trained and CRB check to ensure the safety of the children and also get them to understand the potential impact of being part of this whole talent identification process. So for me, I guess that's a really important starting point in terms of talent identification is for children and young people. It's not for the coaches and for the organization. So it's really important that we build them around those. Once we have those things in place, and I mentioned it before, and it alludes to some of the points you were making, is like understanding the social cultural context. So if we think about England with football, we have a really comprehensive talent identification system when it comes to clubs who are identifying talent. There's regular trials, they've got pyramid structures where they've got players feeding into each levels. Whereas if you go into another member association or country, they don't have anything in place, and they might still love football. So for example, in Africa, there's lots of private academies that recruit players in order to try and sell them on. In North America, they have a pay-to-play system that feeds into like a college system, very similar to some of the countries in Asia. And then you have countries like Western Europe who have more accessible football. So there's lots of different social cultural things that can influence the opportunity to be identified in the first place. And I gave the example of football there, which is a bit of a global sport, but there's also sport popularity. So, for example, if you're born in England, the likelihood of you being identified as an American football player is really slim. Whereas if you're born in America, the odds, although still really small, they obviously increase. So the social culture implications are really important, and obviously that will have a knock-on effect in terms of like how you can create those talent ID structures when it comes to things like resources, both the hardware in terms of physical resources, but also the software in terms of like the skill set and knowledge of the staff who are actually recruiting the athletes. So for me, those were the first two key principles that we as a group really identified to, you know, when we're creating talent ID structures, what are the first things you need to think about?
So just on that, you know, you're thinking about the putting the person before the athlete, which I completely agree with. And I guess the challenge that comes with that is, I guess the people involved in the process is to have a true empathy and an understanding of for that person's journey and their place, right? So I guess there's probably a greater call there for an increased diversity in the people that are making these decisions or making these observations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess a lot of people, they'll tell the athletes when they're joining the pathway, you know, it's still unlikely you're going to make it as an athlete, although you were creating a bit of a platform for you to try and get there. But I don't think there's many athletes who would join a pathway and have that in their mind that this probably isn't going to happen to them. They're going to have the mindset of like, I'm the one who's going to make it in this pathway, and then it doesn't happen to them. And the organization's like, oh, we told you, but we created this platform for you to get there in the first place. So it's a bit of a sticky one, because you want to make sure the athletes understand that the likelihood is they don't make it, but at the same time, you're the one who's creating that platform for them to try and make it. So a lot of organizations now trying to have things like sports psychology practitioners to support athletes if they're going through difficult times, as well as additional support such as like education, well-being, etc., to tee them up if they don't get selected onto the next stage of a pathway.
So I mean, I guess, you know, how do you challenge that, you know, within the research, what does it tell us about in terms of challenging the bias and obviously being more reflective as a practitioner in the observations of these, you know, potential talent? Because I think that, you know, that's effectively where it comes in, right? You won't know it's a bias until you know it's a bias, if you like.
Yeah. And I think the next principle we were talking about, there was two. So the next one is outlining the sport specific landscape. So we talked a little bit about that previously, but that will have a knock on effect to like the resources and infrastructure that is available. A really good example at the moment is skateboarding. So we recently had the Olympics, and you've got kids competing at, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old for gold medals. So they're obviously being identified as potential experts in childhood, whereas you've got other sports like rugby, for example, where you've got forwards who probably don't make their first team debut till they're like 22, 23 years old. So they're already a decade older than these kids who are competing at younger ages. So the needs for the individuals within different pathways is going to be quite considerable. We also need to think about the evolution of sport over time. So if you're thinking about football, identifying kids at 8 years old for your under nines, the professional game in 10 years time, if they're fortunate enough to make their debut at 18, is going to look different to the game that was played 10 years ago. So for example, heading in football, in 10 years time, do you think heading is going to be still in the game? Because they've already reduced it in training, they've removed it from youth football. So that might be a rule that's changed. So that would change completely the dynamics of things like set pieces, or, you know, what the positioning of defenders when, you know, defending goal kicks or throw-ins or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So the evolution of the sport is difficult to predict as well. I actually remember watching Sky Sports and they were talking about how Man City's team has evolved, and all their front four were under like 5'7" or something like that. Don't quote me on that, but they were really short. Whereas compared to 10 years ago, that front four were like 6'2" or above.
Mm.
And that's because the style of play would have been completely different. They would have lumped it forward, tried to hold it up, tried to get the ball high at the pitch. Whereas now it's about breaking lines, being dynamic, beating players one-on-one, in and around the box. So the game's completely changed. And in 10, 20 years' time, we don't know what it's going to look like either. Another good example is if we're identifying athletes in basketball, you know, to be an NBA player, you're going to have to be really tall. If you're going to be in the WNBA, you're going to have to be really tall. So men and women are absolutely massive. And there's only a small proportion of the world's population who are that tall.
Mm.
So again, the needs for the sport is really important. And the pathway that consists of is different depending on the sport. And then I guess the next principle would be focused on like defining what you're doing. So it linked a little bit to what you were talking about in terms of the language that you're using. Are you identifying top performers at that age group to win the under 16s league? Or are you trying to identify players who might not necessarily be the best age group performers, but have showed markers of potential,
mm-hmm.
in order to maybe succeed at adulthood? So you're providing them with that journey. But having a clear definition and defining what you're doing is really important when it comes to talent ID. And that will feed into things like the club or the organization's philosophy, their talent development program, and everything like that as well.
There's a lot in there, obviously. You know, you're talking there. Yeah, there's a lot in there in terms of, you know, just looking at it from all angles. You know, even if you start from the organization in terms of what they're trying to achieve, you're starting with the individuals in place, and I guess putting definitions to the markers that they're looking at. And I think that's really key, though. And I think something you touched on as well that was really important is that they're all the players, all the athletes are going to come into the pathway with the mindset of it's going to be me that makes it, right? And some of those might have that mindset because, you know, when it comes back down to the way that when they're born, their training age, and all the other things, the biological age that comes with it, these are some of the influences are going to have a key part to play in that, right? I guess, you know, an idea that I've always had, and it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on this and where it maybe aligns it, is that we've got to look at it as ages and stages. In the sense that, okay, this might be a 2010 kid, but actually, what does a 2010 kid in January look like in comparison to that one that's born in August or that's born in December? You know, how do we structure that? How does that look? But then obviously, there's a deeper context to that. Like you said, it's understanding the individual, what's their training age been, what's their experience has been. But I guess, I mean, it's such a tricky space, right? Because there is no right answer, I don't think, in any way, shape or form. And it is all subjective and obviously aligned to the needs of the sport, the needs of the individual, the perceptions of the people that are obviously making the observations. So quite often, you know, even if we look at it just from a standard, from a coaching perspective, even the number of times that we see it from a coach's perspective, they like the players who often either played the way that they would have liked to play or played the way that they did play. Or have similarities to that, right? But then to try and value and appreciate different qualities that other people might be bringing into the environments, which could be deemed as talent and could be linked to potential, they can easily get overlooked. And obviously, this is where the bias piece comes in. So I guess, you know, in terms of challenging those biases and having those definitions, you know, what's been some observations or good practice from your observations that has allowed a little bit more black and white in between the gray, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So that links in nicely to the next point I was going to make around principles of talent identification. So you mentioned right at the start there how the players who are selected, you know, hopefully they've got the mindset of they're going to be the next one. But that also makes them have the opportunity to have more coaching, more access to, you know, better resources, better opposition, whatever it is. So it also has the opposite effect for those who aren't selected. So they perhaps don't think they're going to be good enough. They don't have as much competition. They don't have access to the top coaches. So their development isn't happening as much as those who are selected. So they might also have, and that might have a knock-on effect on their confidence or their perceptions of themselves that they're not going to make it. And that could lead to something like dropout or, you know, just the demotivation of not being a professional. It also has a knock-on effect to the parents of who they think the best kids are, but also the coaches to who they think the best kids are. And it's those who are selected into these pathways. So engaging a broad base of athletes within that sport and delaying identification for as long as possible would be a really useful way of trying to keep as many kids in the system as we can to make sure that they're happy and enjoying the sport, but also progressing and developing as potential athletes for senior level, and then almost start identifying and selecting once we get nearer to the end of the talent pathway. So at the minute, there's sports that are recruiting, you know, pre-academy players as young as sort of like 4 or 5 years old. And it's crazy to think that you think that you can identify a player who's going to play in the Premier League. Like, it's impossible. But it's not just impossible to do that. You're also creating, you don't know the unintended consequences of actually doing that in terms of what knock-on effects that can have on the child, which links back to our first point around, like, you know, putting the athlete first, but also the kids who aren't selected at those age groups. So if we go back and get the relative age example of September and August, if you're selecting an under fives team, those who are born in the first 3 months of the year are up to 12 months older, which is 20-25% of your lifespan, which is a huge amount. And you're obviously going to be better than your age group peers as a 4 or 5 year old if you're born in September. So why on earth would you select those kids into pathway? So let's broaden that base, get as many as we can in, invest our infrastructure into grassroots or, you know, foundation sports. So we've got facilities, top coaches working with these young kids, like good organizational structures, and then later select down the line. It doesn't mean it doesn't mean we're doing a disservice to the top players within those pathways, because they're still going to get good coaching, good game time, good competition. Engaging a broad base of players would be key, and then identifying later in the pathway.
Yeah, just on that, because you just got me thinking about a conversation I had recently, and it was just looking at the idea. Well, I completely agree with you. Obviously, the ones with the more positive and the more growth mindset are probably going to gain more from any of the support they're given, whether that be coaching, whether that be sports psychs or whatever else is going on in their journey, right? But the conversation I was having recently, and the question I'm going to throw at you is it obviously some people are going to be influenced by coaching, but I often throw out the debate, if we weren't there as coaches, some of these people would still make it. So is it the coaching that's making a difference? Now, yes, in many cases it could be. It could be the way that, like, you know, the way that messages are landed, the way that things are phrased and articulated for the individual in question to kind of pick up and adopt. But in essence, the talent is still there. It's not like you're bringing, you know, you're helping unpack that talent to an extent, I guess. But yeah, and it kind of speaks to this whole idea that a coach can produce a player. I'm not sure if that's possible at all. I think the coach has to have the capabilities and the ability to actually unearth whatever's there already. And I guess within that also, I guess, puts the stress and the challenge on the coach in this case, or the person observing the individual, to identify where that talent may sit in the future game as well as the here and now. And I think it's really interesting, you know, you highlight the point about the pre-academy stuff, coaches or clubs bringing in players as young as 4 or 5, like you said, with a realistic view of that they can actually identify this 4-year-old as a potential Premier League player in what will be at least, you know, at least 12 years down the line. Never mind understanding what the development journey of that individual looks like alongside the development journey of the game itself. So I guess to your earlier point about, you know, you effectively you're preparing these players to go into an adult life of playing this sport. I do question whether it's actually possible to identify the talent or whether we just look at patterns and trends.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. A little bit of a story, I guess. Before I worked at BCU, I was the head of Academy Sports Science at Exeter City, worked as one of the youth team coaches at under nines. And we had a young player, sort of like 5-6 years old, who came in, and I promise you, he was unbelievable. And I just talked about identifying 5-6 year olds. But he was something like you've never seen before. So he just joined in with us, and he was like a little Messi, and he joined in with us, but he carried on playing grassroots and stuff. And then he was there for a couple of years, and then when it hit the age that they could sign the players, he ended up going to Southampton. And he actually just made his Premier League debut about a month ago. And he started and scored for Southampton at the weekend, Tyler Divlin. So to actually see someone who was that good at that age and then subsequently make it, like, that is rare to actually be able to do that.
But
there's other players who have been in that pathway the same, and they're playing Premier League now, but whether you would have put your money on them making it or not is like a different story. So it is completely different in different circumstances, I think.
And I think what's really interesting is that, you know, you said that, you know, it's something you've never seen before. So obviously there's going to be those outstanding cases, right? In the case of Tyler in this situation. But I guess he was probably so far outside of where his peers were, that it was almost not a guarantee, but it would almost it's not a surprise to see him there, if that makes sense.
And I
think that's the thing that I'm getting at, is that, well, if you've got individuals like that are clearly talented in that respect, and it'd be interesting, especially in that case there, because you said he was 5-6, now training with maybe 8 or 9 year olds in that case, you know, completely different landscape, because it's not you haven't got that debate of, oh, well, he's an early birthday. No, he's just good. And this is the point I'm getting at, really, right, in terms of talent identification pieces. Sometimes I do question when people are looking at talent, especially from a coach's perspective, are you looking at that talent right now based on what they are able to do, i.e. the performance aspect of it, or are you looking at it through the lens of where you think you may be able to add value to that talent?
I think that's the kind of point I was trying to make, is like seeing a kid at that age of being so good, like the fact that he was at Exeter and went to Southampton at 8-9 years old, like, would he still be a professional now? Like, I would say probably, yeah. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean like it's the club who's made, or they're a product of that academy. Mm-hmm. If you think like 30, 40 years ago in England, we had like top players playing in the top league. Maybe they had an under 18s team, but there was nothing underneath, but it was still feeding in the top players. It's just the organizational structures that dictate like what is going into the system, which links back to our previous point around understanding the sport specific landscape. And there's no need to identify players like that at 5-6 years old, because they're going to learn and develop and find a way anyway. So just create that environment so you get more players in that pathway and more opportunity, because that is a really rare example, and the majority of players who have come through that pathway are probably, you know, all taken different journeys. There was some research by Jan Verbeek with the KNVB that looked at the trajectories of players playing for the Netherlands, and they all took completely different pathways. So it's not one size fits all. And I guess using stories like Tyler can have like a almost like a negative impact, because it could be like, oh, but we got this player in at this age and they went all the way through and they've made it. But like, they're only a product of the environment that has been like created for them.
Sure. So just, I guess, on the flip side of that, then, you know, it's probably difficult to really answer this one, and maybe, I guess, articulate in any way, shape or form, in the fact that, has there been any consistent factors, you know, that you've seen in maybe where talent has potentially been identified but has failed to materialize?
Yeah, I think lots of coaches have identified players who they think is going to be the next best player, but doesn't necessarily become the one who they think is going to make it. Yeah, there's, I think it comes down to a lot of like psychosocial skills, because I, even as a player growing up within an academy, like I played with, there was one player in particular who was unbelievable, like outstanding, and he never made it. And yeah, for whatever reason. But there was another player who actually did go through to make it and play in the Premier League, and probably not the player you'd have said was going to play in the Premier League. So, yeah, it's a difficult one to say, like, what is it that it is why they don't make it? Jamie Taylor's got a nice paper out there talking about, like, the almosts, or, like, the ones exploring the characteristics of those who they think coaches thought were going to make it but didn't. And a lot of it does come down to those psychosocial skills.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I guess it links into one of the next points we were going to make around like providing multiple entry and exit points. So it's important that athletes have opportunities to be identified consistently throughout the pathway. So if athletes do not blossom, or they're later matures or whatever, there's still opportunities for them to get in later down the line. So there's almost that continuation of dropping in and dropping out. But also, like, if you are dropping out, how do you support athletes? Is it quite a fluid process? Also things like talent transfer as well, going from like one sport to another. We've seen that recently with like the NFL, with the rugby player going from England playing rugby, or Wales playing rugby union, over to America to play NFL. So that's a bit of a talent transfer, learn a certain skill, how they've been identified from that into that. And that obviously didn't happen until they were an adult. So it's thinking about things like that and providing, you know, a pathway that does have more of a fluid process rather than a structured approach.
I guess within that, in terms of the fluid process, I guess, you know, the challenge comes, and I think goes back to the earlier point, right? They're bringing in kids earlier and earlier because they don't want to miss out on the talent. You know, what are your thoughts on, you know, I guess what they've done in Germany, where they've removed what would have been the foundation phase age groups, and they've kind of gone in at kind of secondary school and above sort of thing. You know, what are your thoughts on that as a move towards a more positive environment to foster the talent?
Yeah, and if you think of rugby in England, the RFU, they've removed selection all the way through to under 16, so you can't actually sign a player with a premiership club until you're under 16. So a lot of clubs are actually reverse, or governing bodies are all reversing based upon the research. Other sports going the other way and selecting younger. The younger you go, the further you away you are from what it is they want to achieve. So you're going to be even more unlikely to be able to identify that. So the closer you get to what it is you want to achieve, the more likely it is you're going to get the right athletes into the pathway. So I think, and linking back to that previous point around like delaying selection and widening the pool of potential talent would be good. Invest in a solid infrastructure within that. I guess within football would be that foundation development phase. And then that could feed into that youth development phase. So yeah, I think it could be beneficial for the sport, as long as you get the organisational structures right in the other end as well. You're not just investing in the top end at under 12s and above, and then you're not really doing anything with the ones below. You need to get them into the sport in the first place. You want them to fall in love with that and have lots of opportunities to play, learn and develop.
You know, that's, again, even that can be quite subjective, right? In the sense that a lot of coaches, a lot of clubs are going to have their own way of working. You know, I've recently had a conversation with a coach who's working at an academy at the moment, and they're talking about the pathways and the challenges that exist for the players, but also the constraints and the pressures that are put on academies themselves, right? In the fact that an academy, especially if you're one of the lower clubs, okay, you know, maybe the smaller clubs, if you like, they're, as much as they'd want to see the player progress and play in the first team, there's probably more incentive for the people in the academy to push them on and get some money out of them, which obviously has a knock-on effect in this whole process as well, right? And, you know, have you got any insights on that?
More personal insights. There's not much research around this. I guess the research is focused around, like, we don't know what talent looks like, so why are we identifying it at those young ages? And I think within that organizational structure you're talking about, it, the environment is constrained based upon the rules and regulations that have been created by humans and people. Like, we're the ones responsible for creating those issues. So I don't get why we don't, you know, adapt them and evolve them in order to meet the needs of the children and the athletes, as well as the, you know, being evidenced informed about, like, what we do know around trajectories. We know we can't identify athletes at those young ages in certain sports. So let's focus on, like, what we can control. But I know, you know, the professionalization of youth sport is, particularly football, is becoming a hugely, like you mentioned money there, it is becoming like a lot about money. Like, clubs are getting huge sums for children, and they are children. They're, a lot of them are under 18. Like, they're getting huge sums of money for children who aren't going to make it as professionals. You will get some that make it naturally because of the system. And that's the stories that you'll hear about. But you won't hear about the ones who don't make it. So, yeah, it's really important. We think about, like, we're the ones who have created these organizational structures. So, like, what can we do in order to make sure that, you know, we are putting the children first before the organizations?
No, that's a great point. I think, you know, just within that, it's just recognizing that, you know, effectively we're trying to professionalize the child's journey from an early age. And I think the challenges that come with it, and you talked about it earlier in terms of the knock-on effect of that, you know, what does it do for the child's mindset, you know, for those that are maybe earlier in the journeys? And I think you made a great point about, in essence, catching them closer to their destination. Because I guess by a certain point, they've probably decided whether it's a pathway that they genuinely want to pursue or not. And I guess that, you know, in essence, probably allows you to streamline the process and making sure that you've got the right individuals before you start thinking about where the talent is.
Yeah.
I guess there's so many, you know, you've probably seen it as well in your experiences, where there's probably so many kids that you look at and you think, well, they might have a talent there, but they've got zero interest in pursuing that talent in this pathway, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, managing that, because, you know, it takes me back to some conversations I have with parents sometimes when I've coached in the past, and it's like, oh, yes, what do you think about my child? Do you think they can, do you think they've got what it takes? Look, I couldn't tell you whether we got what it takes. I haven't got the key that says, here, open the, you know, open the door, walk through it. There's your career. But the one thing that I think is key and is pertinent to what you've just said is that you can't decide for someone whether they actually want to pursue this as a pathway. And that could be the sole reason as to why that talent never succeeds and I guess supersedes wherever it's at. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And we have to flip it on its head a little bit. And, like, I think talent pathways are really useful and beneficial environment to develop talent. We just need to, like, be more strategic in terms of, like, how they are used and how they're implemented with children. Like, I can talk about my personal perspective. I went through Exeter Academy when I was 12, all the way through to 16, and didn't get a scholar. I was released for being too small to be a professional. But those 12 to 16 years, I wouldn't have turned around and been like, I wish I was never in academy. Like, that was a hugely positive experience for me, and I wouldn't have changed that for anything. I had some unbelievable coaches during my time. I met friends that I still speak to now. And just because I didn't make it, it doesn't mean that, like, that talent pathway is not good. Like, I had, like, lots of positives that have come out of that. And I know there's lots of other children and coaches, practitioners that will say the same, as a lot of these kids that are coming in will say how positive the experience is, regardless of whether they've made it or not. You may get some kids who speak differently, but I'm talking about my experience from, like, a 12-year-old plus. It's when we start going a lot younger than that, particularly when we're doing it with kids who have only just started primary school. Like, we're getting further and further away from what it is we want to achieve. And whilst that youth early journey may be beneficial, there's still going to be stages during that where you've got different exits, releases, etc., and that could have a knock-on effect on whether they carry on in the sport, whether they go down a different career path or whatever it is. So I think it's one of those things where, yeah, we need to be strategic about it. And then the rugby example is great because you think they don't select athletes until they're under 16s, but there's still like really strong competition. There's really good grassroots coaches, specialist coaches, etc. So there is a pathway for players there. And if you look at how good England are as a nation, they're one of the top nations in the world. It's one of those where you got to think about the person sometimes more than the organisation.
Just linked to that, you know, you talked about rugby example. You said that obviously remove selection up to under 16. Is that a common thing within the sport?
Within rugby?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Premiership academies can't sign male players.
Outside of England, because it just got me thinking that, you know, if they've done that in England, it's obviously not necessarily going to be the case elsewhere, but if it is across the board, then I guess it kind of just speaks to the point that actually the players who are deemed talented are probably going to be in the right spaces eventually anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And if you do create those, you know, structures for athletes to get involved with at grassroots levels and have got good coaches, good resources, so we're talking like good pitches, you know, good facilities, then, you know, the talent will inevitably make it at the other end. And it, going back to your point previously, though, it is based upon the organisation structure. You've got clubs who are fighting for players because of their value to the club. They might make it as a professional within the club. They might be able to sell them on. The club want them for their value, their talent is value to them. So they're going younger and younger and younger in order to identify that talent and get them into their system. So then they own that player, and then they can sell them or get them into the first team, whatever it is. They've obviously got a duty of care to that athlete, and I think the majority of clubs now have those systems and processes in place we were talking about before. But again, it's going back to the point of like, what is the point of doing that if you know you're unlikely going to be able to get someone at that age and know that they'll make it as a professional? You'll be able to like keep them in the system regardless of whether you sign them or not and do that later down the line. But it's because the structures we've got in place has created that fight for players or need to get them younger or whatever it is.
No, it's a great point. So let's just come back to your principles. And so you said the first principle is about person before the athlete, essentially. The second was that the organisational structure one?
Yeah, thinking more around like the social cultural context.
Yep, social cultural context.
And then the third one, looking at like the sport specific landscape and what the sport wants and needs.
Okay. And then the building on from that, so you've got person before context, social cultural aspects, sport, the need of the sport, and I guess, and is that just
defining what you're doing after that? So thinking about like definitions, philosophy, what it is you want to achieve, and making sure you've got that clarity and alignment.
And it's just take a step back on it. You're looking at this the need of the sport. Is that, and that's referencing the idea of, right, I'm trying to visualize this in my head, but it's like looking at where the player is in their journey. And what is the sport going to look like for them as and when they get to the pinnacle of it, if that's the journey that they're going?
Yeah.
Cool. So then we're following on from that, was the fourth one, sorry?
So the fourth one, defining what you're doing in terms of the philosophy, language, etc. And then the fifth one around engaging a broad base of athletes, delaying identification for as long as possible. And then the sixth one, providing multiple entry and exit points when it comes to selection, deselection, and obviously talent identification, consistently during those processes. And then that leads us into the next one, which was around a lot of the stuff that you were talking about at the start in terms of recognizing possible biases and implement strategies. So we're not just recognizing these biases, for example, relative age, biological maturation, what are we actually doing about it in terms of strategies? So we're implementing, we're making explicit what the relative age of each athlete is during trials or during talent ID. Oh, that kid's a birth quarter four. They're obviously not going to be as good as this kid who's birth quarter one, who's outstanding. It might be like doing biological maturation, whether that's through visual observation or whether that's through more objective measures. So it's really important that we understand those different biases that can impact upon our decision making during selection, but also in not just recognize those, what strategies do we actually have in place? There's a really good example that we've done within England squash, actually. And it's more around not just talent ID, but also development as part of their pathway. They use an approach called birthday banding. So they band athletes based upon their age at that moment in time. So say, for example, you've been selected as a 13-year-old into their talent pathway. You've just turned 13. You'll play against all the other 13-year-olds, but you'll be the youngest. But then during your 12 months as a 13-year-old towards when you turn 14, you start to become the oldest 13-year-old. Yep. And then on your 14th birthday, all of a sudden, you drop back down and you're the youngest. So that creates a more non-linear pathway in terms of diverse perspectives of being a birth call, 1, 2, 3, 4. But also coaches recognize where that individual athlete is at that moment in time.
And what's been the reflection or the feedback on that type of approach? Because I guess, you know, the first thing that came into my head straight away is giving you real diverse experiences across, you know, not just because of your age, but there'll be times where even when you're the younger one, you might still be more dominant than the older one, and vice versa. And you know, having the opportunity to really experience that and enrich the, I guess, the athlete with those experiences in the first instance.
Yeah, we've just finished off a qualitative piece, actually, that where we've discussed or spoke to the stakeholders who use it and spoken really positively about it. One of the things linked to what you were talking about, you know, play, if they're like a really good young 13-year-old, it creates a really fluid process. So there's nothing wrong with that young 13-year-old going and playing with 14-year-olds. You know, it's really adaptable and fluid. So that was one of the positives, is they're not really constrained by age. It's based more upon the individual. It's also been really positive in terms of creating those diverse perspectives, so challenging the younger athletes against the older athletes. But then when they get to the other end, you know, being the oldest athlete and having that more of an advantage can create, like, things like confidence as well. So there's things like that that come out. One of the pitfalls was because of the annual competitions that they have, you're either the relatively oldest or youngest, wherever you are, every year during those competitions, which has an impact upon things like ranking and stuff. So that was one of the things they mentioned. But again, that's because formal competition comes into play, and that has a knock-on effect on, you know, the athlete's ability within those competitions. So that was one of the potential pitfalls. But there's lots of other potential solutions as well. Like, there's been there's a lot of research with Sean Cumming around biobanding and grouping athletes based upon biological age. Stephen Copley and his team have done a lot of research around corrective adjustments during things like timed sports or sports based on distance and time, because you can correctively adjust the score based upon their biological age, relative age, and performance. So you get a more accurate representation of where they are at. And I guess you've got other sports that use things like belt color or like ability grouping, such as, like, you know, how good you are. So like martial arts, you'd be like a certain color belt. So yeah, there's lots of sports that use potentially different things, but I feel we're still fixed in this mindset of grouping athletes based upon age, particularly within organized team sports.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because obviously, you know, within football as well, they talk a lot of, especially, and I think it was a big thing at Man United in particular, where they talk about, you know, that cage football, that street football environment, and that development. I just think back, and I'm sure you've had probably similar experiences when you was younger. You know, I was playing with like 16, 17-year-olds when I was 10, 11. It just, I mean, I didn't always get the ball, and I probably didn't have much contact with the ball, but I was in the environment, right? And then there'll be times where you're having that interaction and that feeling of, right, what does it look like to play against the older player, and what does it feel like to play against the younger player? And, you know, sometimes in a completely unsupervised environment. There's not someone there standing telling you when the challenges are too hard or too difficult. It's just you just kind of learn to deal with it, understand it, and experience the situations for what they are. Right. So I guess there is some real merit in those experiences, which I feel like some of these approaches that you've kind of shared, I guess, at least in the way I look at them, almost indirectly trying to bring back in because they've almost been phased out because of societal and changes that we've faced as well.
Yeah, yeah. I've mentioned this previously on another podcast, but I remember watching Sky Sports Soccer AM, and John Stones was on there talking about his first tears. So they were doing that interviews, like, what was your first? And one of them was, what was your first tears in football? And he said, when he was in Barnsley Academy, he was pulled in and he was told he was going to be playing down an age group for the next year. And he said how, like, devastated he was and, like, thought he wasn't good enough. But then looking back now, he actually said how that was, like, actually a positive influence on his development, whether that's because he actually wanted to show the coaches he was good enough because he thought it was a negative experience, or whether it's because the coaches were actually right and created the right environment. You know, who knows? But then in the same interview, Harry Maguire did it, and he talked about, like, some of his first experiences playing football. And he talked about how he used to play up an age group with his older brother. His dad was the coach, so he had to take both of them. So he went and played up an age group. So it just got me thinking, you had these two centre-halves who started for England together in the Euro final, who had taken these two different pathways, one playing up, one playing down. But, like, it was the right environment for them at that moment. So I think, yeah, thinking about using those types of strategies as well, like playing up, playing down, but using it in the right way can be really useful for athletes. Not thinking you're constrained by being the best under 12 age group or being the best under 15 age group.
Yeah, I guess it is a difficult one, though, isn't it? Because sometimes it's not just from the players, it's from their support network, that association of they're playing up an age group. So that means they must be doing really well. Not to say that doesn't mean that, or it doesn't mean anything different, but I think the key, the word that's jumping out at me just as you were sharing is it just goes back to education and clarity, right? It giving clarity to the players and the people within and around them around why these decisions are being made, what the rationale is, and where the justification is for these things. It's not to say that this is a right or wrong decision. It's just this is what we've observed, and this is why we think this might be a useful strategy to support and develop this individual.
Yeah, definitely. And even when we're making those decisions, it links to the next point, or the next sort of, like, principle is around, like, acknowledging that making prognoses about an athlete's potential or the coach's eye isn't easy. So there's often people who think they know what they're looking for, or don't really show that vulnerability that they can be wrong, or a lot of the time they will be wrong, particularly within talent pathways. So, you know, understanding that, you know, it is really difficult to use the coach's eye. It's not easy, and making those decisions based just upon that can be difficult. So thinking about multidisciplinary or multidimensional assessments will be really important. How valid and reliable are those methods that you're using? The cricket uses this analogy, which I think is great, using multiple eyes multiple times. So you're not just getting one person to observe the player a single time. The same person observes them multiple times, but along with multiple people, to make sure you're more accurate and agreeable with what you're observing. And it is important to understand that, like, it is a longitudinal process, not to just go to a trial, select an athlete based on how good they are at that moment, how good or how much potential do they have to join that journey in the long term. So yeah, a lot of what we do is subjective, and we're identifying athletes on things like gut instinct, intuition, etc. So yeah, how can we be more accurate with those decisions?
Yeah, but I guess, you know, that element of gut instinct and, you know, the intuition piece, I guess it is probably linked to previous experiences, which I guess maybe haven't formally been consolidated. And I think, you know, that obviously experience does have a part to play. You know, your observations, there's only so many times you're going to see something before you decide to, actually, there's probably a pattern here, right? But obviously, I guess keeping your mind open to the fact that even within this, I guess, the path of those patterns, it might be slightly different, and that's okay. But also, you know, I think what's a really interesting conversation I've had before with people around the idea of when recruitment staff and talent identification staff in particular are bringing players in or athletes into an organization, how often is there a consideration for who that player is then going to be supervised by as part of, you know, as their coach, as an example? Mm. Has that coach's personality, coach's ability, and that coach's you know, characteristics been taken into account in marrying up whether this is the right environment, whether this player is going to be suitable for this environment, if that makes sense?
Yeah, you definitely know? That point links in nicely to the next principle, where we talk about like co-creating a shared mental model for different ages and stages of development. So it's not just a coach who's going, or a recruiter going, to watch an athlete and choosing them based upon their intuition. Their player observation is based upon a shared mental model, which is co-created by stakeholders within the club or the organization. So they're all working towards the same goals and the same skill sets that they think are relevant for a player with potential. And all those things that are created will be different based upon athletes at different ages and stages of their development. So for example, an under 12 would be different to identifying an under 18. The different skill sets will be diverse. So using a more formal shared mental model or player observation that captures multi-dimensional characteristics will be really important. And recognizing that it isn't a one size fits all as well. There'll be different skill sets for different athletes across different positions and different sports.
100%. I guess this comes to, like you said, the ages and stages, and even profiling the players based on the needs of the individual in the organization, or in, if you take it one step further, what are the needs of the sport? And obviously that's going to have one eye on it, right? And I think one of the challenges often come in is, well, at what level are we observing this talent for? So is it we're looking at this individual and we're saying, right, we're trying to currently identify a player who may play in the Premier League, or actually is there a different pathway for this player in the fact that we're a League Two club, we want this player to potentially play in our first team? So the characteristics in that respect may be very different, right?
Yeah, definitely. So I think, you know, having that co-created shared mental model is important for a club, because they're then understanding what the needs are for that club and what those characteristics for a potential athlete within that club will look like. So that's really important, firstly, in terms of, you know, subjective or player observations from a recruiter's perspective. But the next point is around like considering what objective measures you can support to support your decision making of an athlete. So you can become more objective when you've got like player ratings or like Likert scales for the same skill sets. So you can use that more qualitative data, but more objective data in terms of like, what is a player's relative age? What is a athlete's biological age? What is their training age? You can use things like fitness testing, performance analysis tools, GPS. You know, there's lots of really useful objective measures, which will obviously depend, going back to the initial point we made around like the social cultural context in the sport, in terms of what they can have access to, finances, knowledge, etc. But it's really important that you do consider those objective measures, and some of them are really easy. Like relative age isn't difficult to measure. Biological maturation can be a little bit more difficult, but if you work with a inter or transdisciplinary team, you can use the sports science department to help support you with that and help inform you. The same with things like fitness testing, performance analysis, etc. Getting information around the player's background and their social cultural context is really important as well. So yeah, consider what objective measures you can use to help support your decision making will be really important.
100%. I guess, you know, there's so many variables to consider, right? And I think, you know, I think it's good, obviously, when you now structure it in the form of having these principles, because again, it gives a logical process for people to kind of think about and consider in their own approaches in terms of like how they're currently observing talent, assessing talent, and what maybe they could be doing to strategize it more effectively. So, I mean, you've left me with so many questions in my head, right? I'm just thinking now, how do we transfer this into a more actionable method that even people from a young, from, you know, working in that, that maybe aren't in the talent pathways, aren't in the elite pathways, people even in grassroots, of how they can maybe support and identify talent or potential in just engaging participants into the sports.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess we got three more principles that I've not covered yet. The first one links back to the point I was making previously around like aligning and working across inter and transdisciplinary teams. A lot of the time, professional organizations work in multidisciplinary teams, so they're often in their silos doing their own thing. So trying to encourage more interdisciplinary, where you're actually working as a team together. And I think it's becoming more common at high performance, at senior level, but within youth levels, a lot of it is individual, and the coach is often the one who is the decision maker rather than the interdisciplinary team being the decision makers. So that's a key one, is like, how can you enhance your work through inter and transdisciplinary teams? And I guess the last two were linking very much to what you were saying there in terms of like, how can we implement these actions? These principles we sort of co-created within the Tides was very much to try and be practitioner and policy focused, because, you know, we want to be evidence-based and help positively inform youth sports settings. But ultimately, it's those who are out in the field and practitioners who are going to be, and policymakers who are the ones who are going to be able to implement these changes. We can only offer our, you know, expertise or our thoughts within these areas. So the other one is, well, it links to that one in terms of working in transdisciplinary teams. So like, how can you look beyond your club and work with like universities or education settings to try and really positively influence your talent development systems, not just within clubs, but like at organizational level and governing body level. I think would be really beneficial. It also comes with multiple benefits, such as like placement opportunities for young students who are coming in and learning what the clubs and organizations are doing, which has a positive knock-on effect to like the next generation who are actually going to get the jobs after. But also, like you were talking about, like education, like you really need to design and implement an education framework around talent identification. A lot of the education within sports coaching and athlete development is focused around like the development process, coaching, designing sessions, not really around like, how do we actually identify and select those athletes who go into those systems, but also the vice versa. What is the knock-on effect of these systems? So it's really important that we do create an education framework within our systems to understand how we can change habits and make sure that we are doing the right things, and we are putting the athlete first, etc. And then the last principle I was going to mention was around like reviewing talent identification processes regularly, not just doing what you do.
I was about to ask you, to be honest. You know, I guess the key thing that kind of stood out for me is, obviously, you know, it's all well and good having these things, but there needs to be a constant reflection, right? Are they working? What's working? What's not working? How do we further develop?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people just do what's always been done. They'll do what they were done as athletes, how they were selected as athletes, and now they're coaches, so they'll do what was done to them. So it's important to change that mindset and understand the new knowledge within the area. Constantly evolve in practice based upon like what you're implementing, but also evaluating it. So for example, if you're implementing strategies to negate against possible biases, it may actually have unintended consequences. So it might actually have a negative effect on what you're trying to do. You might decrease enjoyment. For example, if you implement a different grouping strategy, athletes are now removed from their age group friends and they're like, oh, I just want to go and play with my friends. So it might have, but that's part of like regularly reviewing your talent ID processes or development processes, and having those like conversations regularly within your trans multidisciplinary teams, interdisciplinary teams, are really important. Regular CPD, reflexivity, all those types of things will be really important for knowledge mobilization and in talent ID.
100%. I guess the key thing for that is, well, not just a reflection, but how regularly should regularly be? Because, right, you've got to give enough time for things to work as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's not a one size fits all. It's dependent on the organization, whether they work in like those micro, macro, meso cycles, like weekly, monthly, annual, 6 weekly, whatever it is. Who's responsible for leading that CPD and talent identification? They should be the ones who are creating that based upon what is already being delivered within the club and coming up with ways in which that they can evaluate that and re-disseminate that within the team.
Just to finish off, then, maybe just any final words around where people can maybe get in touch with you and find out a little bit more about your work.
So we regularly work with national governing bodies, ranging from international federations through to regional sports clubs within the Birmingham area and everything in between. So we're always looking for people who want to learn more and collaborate. So yeah, we've got the BCU Raised Lab, which you could find on Google. My personal Twitter account, AdamKelly07, or X, sorry, X account. And my email is adam.kelly@bcu.ac.uk. So yeah, feel free to email me if you've got any follow-up questions. We do have the Tides position statement that I discussed today, which was contributed to by lots of different researchers from across the world. Hopefully we'll have that out soon, so people can read through that and yeah. Hopefully implement some of those thoughts into practice.
Awesome. Adam, I really appreciate your time today. There's loads to think about. Again, I've still got a few things bubbling in my head around some of the conversations I've had before and how it might challenge people's thinking now to kind of raise some of the things that you've spoken about. So again, massively appreciate your time. Took a few weeks getting there, but we got there in the end.
Yeah. Nice one.
I really appreciate it. Cheers for that, Adam.
Yeah, no worries.
There you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Ohio seniors, it's time to make the right call for better Medicare benefits with Medical Mutual. Plans start at $0 per month and include $0 doctor visits and $0 generic prescription drugs. Visit medmutual.com/review or call 1-866-966-9338 to find a plan today. MedMutual Advantage plans are HMO, HMO, POS, and PPO plans offered by Medical Mutual of Ohio with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in a MedMutual Advantage plan depends on contract renewal.